joint meeting of the House and Senate Senate Judiciary Committee, House Civil Judiciary Committee for a special hearing on House Bill 2525. Counsel, maybe to save time, I'll just step down and do the overview for the committee. And while I'm down, I'll invite Chip Lazenby and David Schuman to meet me at the table, and I'll pass the gavel.
Thank you.
Should have probably gone to chair of the House committee.
Dream come true?
Yes, that's true. Your committee just reminded me it's I should be careful for what I wish for. It could come true. Well, Mr. Chair, who would like to begin the testimony?
Mr. Chair. I will.
For the record, Lane Shatterly, State Representative District 34, and a co-sponsor, one of the co-chief sponsors of House Bill 2525 at the request of the governor. A little history for those of you who either weren't paying attention or weren't around last session. House Bill 2948 was the 1997 iteration of a bill that even has some earlier antecedents, in that it was a bill that would have created an independent office of administrative hearings, that is to conduct hearings in contested cases before administrative agencies. The bill passed the House and it passed the Senate, I think, by a vote of 25-1, and was thereupon vetoed at the end of the session by the governor. What followed from that, though, was a work group that Mr. Lazenby and I co-chaired, and that Mr. Schuman, who was here with me as well, sat in on, that was representative of course, the governor's office and the attorney general's office, but also had legislative members and agency members. And we met on about a monthly basis through most of the interim. And then in addition to that, Mr. Lazenby and Mr. Schuman and I met even more often than that, hammering out a bill that you have before you in House Bill 2525 with the amendments now as of, I think, last week that represent the consensus amendments that give the final shape to the bill. Those amendments that I'm referring to are the amendments that are outlined in David Hendricks's memorandum of April 23. That memorandum identifies exactly what those amendments are and what they do, so you should have a copy of the memo and a copy of the amendments. And I think before I begin my overview of the bill, I will say that I have the greatest, want to express thanks to Mr. Schuman and Mr. Lazenby in the governor's office for their efforts on this. This has been an arduous effort to get to a point where we have, I think, a consensus, a fragile consensus, but a consensus nonetheless on a bill that the governor's office has indicated its support with the amendments that are before you today. And I think it speaks well of what can be done through some good hard work and a commitment to a collaborative effort, even in this building and even in the third or fourth month of the session. To outline the issue that gave rise to House Bill 2948 last session, I'll just give you the most thumbnail sketch of the scenario that sort of instigated the efforts on the bill last session, and then I'll bring you forward to this session, and I will simplify it, and in that, of course, it not entirely represent everything accurately, but it will give you an idea of what it was behind the bill that brought it forward. And that is a situation under current law in terms of enforcing administrative rules where the agencies basically have control of the not only enforcement but also then of the hearings process, so that in a typical scenario, and to use what for Mr. Schuman and Mr. Lazenby will be a tired example, but we're getting down to the end, so we'll probably have to use it less. If you are a restaurant and bar owner, a licensee of OLCC, you are going to be subject to regulatory oversight by the Liquor Control Commission. And if OLCC determines through an investigation that you have violated the terms of your OLCC license, it may be that OLCC will issue some form of order or action against you, perhaps from amounting to a fine, to a suspension of your license, to outright revocation of the license. And under current procedure, and this is typical in most state agencies, your avenue of recourse upon notice of the proposed agency action against you is to request a hearing before the agency. And that gets you into the world of a contested case administrative hearings. And in this case, the hearing would be conducted by a hearings officer employed by OLCC. And so if I'm the licensee and could give perhaps some pause to face a hearing in front of a hearing officer of the agency that has already at least made a determination that I've probably violated administrative rule or law. And so you proceed to this hearing in front of the agency's hearing officer. And at the hearing, what the agency is doing is basically collecting additional facts on which to base its ultimate final action. The agency may be represented at the hearing by an attorney from the Department of Justice. That is, the attorney may appear for the agency before the hearings officer, and it has the look and feel of a trial in many respects. When the hearing is over and I, as the licensee, go home, under current law, there is nothing to prohibit that hearing officer who heard the case from visiting either directly with the attorney from the Attorney General's office who spoke on behalf of the agency at the hearing to be advised by that attorney on the law or the application of the law to the facts and to direct help direct the hearings officer how the case should be decided. Nor is there anything that would prohibit under current law a visit from a director or assistant director or somebody else in the agency directly to the hearing officer to help instruct them perhaps on issues not apparently in the record or other considerations that may drive how the case should be decided. All of this being done ex parte, that is, not on the record and not with the benefit of the licensee's participation or even knowledge. And then even after that, the hearings officer in most cases would prepare a proposed order that would then go to the director of the agency, and the agency director has the opportunity, even without the opportunity to have participated in the hearings process, to change the order and to make the outcome suit the director's proclivities. That obviously raises some concerns about fairness and independence in the process. And this is much about perception as it is about reality. We did have testimony last session about cases in which there were abuses of this power, and there were comments made during the work group over the interim about the same kind of actual abuses. But frankly, it is as much about a perception of fairness as anything else, and I likened it to a situation where you might be stopped by the police officer, issued a citation, and go to court to contest your traffic ticket, only to find out that the judge works for the police agency that cited you. And that's a system that I think is inherently unfair and not conducive of public trust. One final piece of this scenario for background purposes is what happens on appeal. If after all of this the licensee loses at the agency level, it would be one thing if there was, I think, what I would say, meaningful review at the in the courts. But what the courts review the agency determination for is called substantial evidence. So basically, if there is evidence in the record to support the agency's determination, the court will support the agency. And so it really doesn't offer the licensee an opportunity for a clean shot at the issue when they get in front of the Court of Appeals. This bill substantially changes how this process will take place. Now, again, last session, 2948 would have established an independent Office of Administrative Hearings. There were some concerns about the budget impacts of that and other aspects of the bill that led to the governor's veto. What you have in House Bill 2525 is the establishment of a hearing officer panel within the Employment Department. What happened after last session in the work group was that as we got to looking around what was happening actually statewide, or that is, through state government, we learned that the Employment Department really functions almost as a de facto central panel for a lot of boards and commissions that don't have their own hearing officers already. They contract with the Employment Department to do a lot of the hearings, and so that became sort of the choice du jour of the group to place this panel within the Employment Department. It saves on overhead. It has some of the budgetary functions that can be handled by the Employment Department without having to create new overhead to set up a new independent agency. The panel will be administered by a chief hearing officer, and the panel is set up as a pilot program. It sunsets on January 1 of 2004. It is a substantial change in the way the state does business in the conduct of contested case administrative hearings, and I think it's fair that it get a look at in about 4 years' time, 3 years' time, after it starts, to make sure that it is operating as we expect that it will. The bill provides for transfers of employees to the Employment Department to serve in the central panel, that is, so agencies who now that are covered by the bill, who have their own stable of hearing officers and support employees, those hearing officers and support employees will be transferred to the Employment Department, not physically, but for administrative purposes, to the to serve the hearing officer panel. Something else about House Bill 2948 that is distinguished from 2525 that we have before us. 2948 had very much a menu of agencies and board commissions that were selected for inclusion in the bill. Agencies that were not included in the bill were automatically excluded from the bill. That bill was also intended to serve as something of a pilot project. This bill takes the opposite approach, and it starts with the presumption that boards, agencies, and commissions are in the bill, that is, required to use the panel for the conduct of hearings, unless they are specifically excluded. Section 9 identifies the agencies, boards, and commissions that are excluded, as well as there are some amendments on that subject as well. The conduct of the hearings must be pursuant to the Attorney General model rules, unless the Attorney General exempts agencies from the model rules. Also, it provides that an agency that uses a hearing officer from the panel is allowed to delegate to the hearing officer the authority to enter a final order for the agency. Some agencies do that already. This will just simply carry that process through if they wish to do that. Otherwise, a draft order will go back to the agency and will be issued out as a final product of the agency. One of the key components of House Bill 2525 is a limitation by the agency on modification on modifying findings of historic fact. And the function of the hearing primarily is to determine the facts, provide an impartial, independent forum for determining what the facts are that are driving a particular case. Some of those facts are going to be historic facts. The prime example was the light red or green. That is going to be a historic fact. The hearing officer is going to be in the position of hearing witnesses and observing witnesses testify on to any disputed historic facts and then making a determination as to credibility and other indicia of reliability of the evidence and making a finding. In House Bill 2525, historic facts may not be modified by the agency when that draft opinion or draft order goes to the agency, unless the agency determines that the hearing officer made a mistake. That is, unless the agency determines that the record does not support the hearing officer's findings of historic fact by a preponderance of evidence in the record. This supports the independent factual determination of the hearing officer as to historic facts. And with the Dash 23 amendments, the bill defines historic facts as being, I just refer to this so we're not just clear, that a event did or did not occur, or that a circumstance did or did not exist. It's looking at things that have happened in the past that either did or did not occur, or did or did not exist. It is not intended in any way to limit the agency's expertise and ability to draw inferences from facts. One example that we toss around between ourselves is it may be a historic fact to decide at what temperature the water was when the fish began to die in a particular study or report. But if the idea is the hearing officer is taking collecting evidence from a number of reports and then making a conclusion from those reports as to prospectively what water temperature will, at what water temperature will fish begin to die, that fact derived from a group of reports or testimony that is more predictive in nature than retroactive would not constitute a historic fact, but would be a determination still within the province of the agency. If the agency does modify an order, it has to do it on the record so that everyone knows where the agency has departed from the hearing officer. I think that will enhance the credibility of the process. There are budget pieces of the bill. I won't spend any time on those, but another thing that I want to stress before I finish here, standards and training. I think the important aspect of the bill is that it will drive a process by which hearing officers that the state uses for all agencies, boards, and commissions will be trained to uniform standards and expectations of competence and performance. That will help make hearing officers fungible, and that is one of the benefits of this bill, so that if you've got a hearing officer right now that is exclusively assigned to OLCC, that hearing officer will be available to hear cases from any other agencies as well, so that if right now you have OLCC cases in a downtime, so the hearing officers are not getting a lot of action and not being fully utilized in this central panel, those hearing officers will be available to hear other cases, other agency cases, and it makes them more efficient. It makes the hearing process more efficient. This standards and training will help move that forward. Ex parte contacts is another key element of the bill. What it does is that it requires the hearing officer to disclose ex parte contacts. So now that if a contact is made about the case off the record by an agency or by a party, that is by the citizen party, then the hearing officer is required to make that contact known to the other interested parties, that is to the agency or to the private party, depending on where the contact came from, so that the everybody has an opportunity to participate in these contacts, and there's nothing going on behind closed doors that are going to materially affect the outcome of the case. The bill also establishes an oversight committee. I think that's important since this is a pilot project. We want to make sure that it's being implemented to its fullest and that any problems with it can be identified early and addressed in the next session. The Oversight Committee includes both legislative, executive, and Department of Justice representatives, as well as private practitioners who have experience in administrative law matters. I think that's about all I will have to say about the bill for now. I'll pass it over to Mr. Lazenby or Mr. Schumann, except to say that you do have the amendments before you. We can go through those one at a time shortly here, perhaps. But I want to call your attention to a letter from Mr. Lazenby that's dated, I think, on Friday that is based on the bill with the amendments that are before you as reflected in Mr. Hendricks' memorandum. And that basically confirms that this is the package of amendments, concept of the bill that the governor is in support of and has indicated willingness to sign, according to Mr. Lazenby's letter. And so I will say up front that there are amendments to this bill that I would have just assumed seen in the bill that are not in the bill. But this is a process, of course, politics being the art of the possible. I have made the decision for myself as the chief co-sponsors of the bill. I would rather have a bill than not a bill. And I know that there are parts of the bill that go farther than Mr. Lazenby is comfortable with and Mr. Schuman is comfortable with, so I guess that makes it a good compromise effort. It is a tremendous step in the right direction. We are not a pioneer in this effort. I think 23, 24 states have preceded us in moving this direction. I met this last fall with a couple of chief hearing officers from other states at the National Administrative Law Judge Conference. This concept works. It works well. It serves the process. It serves citizen confidence in the administrative hearings process and the work that agencies do in contested cases. It is, I think, a revolutionary change in the way Oregon government relates to the citizens that will enhance confidence in how we do business in the Capitol. And again, I want to commend Mr. Lazenby and Mr. Schuman for their efforts and for the points that they have given us, frankly, in getting to this point in the bill that we have before them.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm legal counsel to Governor John Sitkovar. I had passed out to the committee a PowerPoint presentation on the bill that is similar to the material that Representative Shetterly has shared with you, outlined some of the salient features that we undertook in our interim study. I want to amplify a couple of things that Representative Shetterly said and especially speak to his perspective from the governor's office. First, beginning with House Bill 2948 in the last session. That was a bill that received considerable support in the legislature, 39 votes in the House, and 20 votes in the Senate. It was a fortunately rare example of bipartisan cooperation.
Was that unfortunate?
Unfortunately, it was rare, unfortunate part of it. However, there were some problems with the bill. As the bill progressed through the legislative session, proponents of the bill were saying that this could save us $3 million in the biennium. And opponents of the bill were saying, mostly coming from agency folks, but coming from DASH and from the budget folks, that this could cost us just $12 million just to get it start up and running. And a $15 million swing was just something that was really unacceptable. I think it's also important to understand the context of this bill, exactly what the nature of these hearings are. Representative Shetterly, in his presentation, mentioned that these hearings, when you get there, have the look and feel of a trial. But we began our deliberations from the point of view and understanding that administrative contested case hearings are not trials. They are not opportunities to put an agency on trial in front of a neutral trier of fact and have the agency found guilty or not guilty. It is a process for someone who assists the agency to sort facts so that the agency, in fact, can issue a final order that is consistent with its policies and consistent with the facts that are in the record. With that in mind, we approach these negotiations from the executive branch with a view towards, as Representative Shetterly pointed out, increasing the perception of fairness in connection with these hearings. Let me also say that as we started going down this road, there were a number of preconceived notions in connection with House Bill 2948 that it became very clear to the participants of my work group would be difficult to decide one way or another. Proponents of the bill were saying that this would save us a lot of money. Opponents of the bill were saying it was going to be costly. There were proponents of the bill who were saying that there's pent-up demand out there on the part of citizens and others who appear before agencies to have a hearings officer whose paycheck doesn't come from the agency. But when we ask for hard numbers and when we ask for actual cases, this became more anecdotal than anything else. Part of the reason that this is a pilot program is that we hope to be able to see through the course of these 4 years how much of these perceptions actually have a basis in reality. The bill sets up a chief hearings officer who, for the first 2 years of this pilot program, will be developing standards and training for hearings officers, so that hopefully we will end up with a cadre of professionally trained hearings officers across state government who will also be flexible in terms of perhaps disciplines, but also will be more consistent in terms of their overall skill level and professionalism that we see, so that the quality of contested case hearing results that we get across state government will be more uniform. That, I think, is one of the good government features of this bill. We changed the ex parte provisions from House Bill 2948 from one that resembles the more punitive and sanctioned system that you see in courts, where if you have contact with a judge and you are a representative party or you represent one side, there are sanctions that can attach, which is what 2948 contemplated. We turn this instead into an opportunity to comment for the hearings officer to identify those circumstances and then present the other side an opportunity to comment so that the record itself was complete. That, I think, is a much fairer approach to this issue. And we also took steps to safeguard legal advice that was provided both to the hearings officer and also to the agency so that these contested case hearings would not turn into discovery stalking horses for larger litigation that might be afoot in the line. Representative Shedley also touched briefly on the issue of how appeals are taken from contested case hearings, and it is true that at this point in time, if you were to take an appeal of an adverse ruling in a contested case hearing, the Court of Appeals standard would be substantial evidence in the record to support the agency's finding. And that is a fairly good threshold for the agency to meet if they have the record that's before them. We did have discussions early on about whether or not we want to change that, but let me suggest to the members of the committee that this is something that needs to have separate and isolated deliberation in and of itself. It has a huge impact on the judicial budget. It has a huge impact on the speed at which government decisions are made, and there are a lot of untoward consequences of doing that. To the extent that section, the Dash 23 amendments, do use the word de novo, the committee should note that it is de novo review for a very narrow class of issues. There are issues where the agency purports to have found, by preponderance of the evidence, having the ability to alter facts within the record. It is that determination and that determination alone that is subject to de novo review. And for the lawyers, the techno geeks in the audience, this is a very narrow definition, but a very important one. One of the things that lurks in this is really my opinion, but I think that it's a policy piece for all of you to consider, is that House Bill 2948 in last session and House Bill 2525 to a certain extent does represent a departure from what Oregon has done in the past. It is moving towards what goes on in some states, and certainly it is a move towards what goes on in the federal system, where you have a cadre of independent administrative law judges who have the ability to direct agencies to spend money in certain ways and to enact certain policies. This can have a tremendous impact on your ability as legislators to control the budget and to direct agency policy through legislation. One of the objections to 2948 was that it created a group of people that were answerable to no one, not to you and not to the executive branch. We think that we have accountability in this bill through the Oversight Committee, and we think that we have come up with some compromises in this, as Representative Shedley pointed out, that are good government, that represent compromises, that we will be able to see over stretch of ground whether or not there are some positive gains to be made. With that, I just would leave you with the PowerPoint presentation, which walks through some of the pieces of that. I guess we're going to end up talking about the different amendments. But David Schuman helped us out with really the role of the Department of Justice and provision of legal advice and some other structural issues with the bill. So I turn this over to him.
I have one question.
Thanks, Chip.
Why don't we hear the panel presentation, okay, then we'll open up for questions.
Okay. David.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Schuman. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'll just say a very few words. I was not one of the co-chairs of this committee. I participated in the deliberations that have gone on for almost a year and a half, 2 years now. We learned in looking at this, the prior iteration of this bill in 1997, that people approach this subject of administrative contested case hearings from widely divergent positions. On the one hand, you have people who see the administrative process as really nothing more than the implementation of a larger policy decision that's been made by the legislature, and both the rulemaking and the contested case function is to put into effect a broad policy decision, and that to the extent that you adjudicate contested cases involving individuals in that process, they're not trials. They are really nothing more than an attempt to articulate a consistent and coherent policy in particular cases. On the other hand, you have people pointing out that when administrative bodies conduct contested cases, they are deciding extremely important issues in the lives of real people, and that to fold those into some sort of articulation of broader policy is in some senses to be extremely unfair, and when people's important rights are at stake, they deserve a certain amount of procedural protections. This is a problem that's become much more focused in the last 20 or 30 years. We didn't have administrative law in this country until the 40s, and since the 40s, as you all know, the number of administrative agencies, the quantity of administrative hearings, and the amount of due process to which individuals are constitutionally entitled have all grown enormously. This bill is a compromise. I think that it is a good compromise. Everybody involved in crafting this bill gave up a lot. I think both Mr. Lazenby and Mr. Shetterly are to be commended for bringing to the table the objective of coming up with a good government bill as opposed to a bill that's going to protect and make life easier for a particular constituency or group of stakeholders. There are people in the Department of Justice who think that by participating in this process, I have given away the ranch. I'm sure you will also hear from people today who regard this as only a very small and inadequate step towards instituting a kind of procedural fairness in the administrative process. This is a bill that I think in some senses is going to make almost everybody unhappy in one way or another, and that's probably a sign that it is a good compromise. Questions?
Thank you. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. First, as a court reporter, I just have to ask this question. You say it has the look and the feel of a trial. How are you going to preserve the record? Are you going to preserve the record?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I don't think this bill contemplates any change in that. I think the record is preserved in administrative hearings for the most part on an agency-by-agency basis. I think most of them do it simply by audio recording. I think there are some agencies, though, that do actually employ court reporters. But this bill won't change that process.
Okay. And second question, if I may?
Yes.
My second question is that I see in the bill, and I like this bill, actually. It's very good. You've exempted out the Workers' Compensation Board, not the division, but the board itself, so workers' comp hearings would be held as they always are.
Sure.
I have an email here from Randolph Stevens, who wants the Construction Contractors Board exempted out. So how can you address those concerns and why one board is left out and not the other?
Well, I'll take a stab at that first, Mr. Chair, Representative Walker. That's one of these great compromise aspects of the bill. Frankly, I tried to get the Construction Contractors Board exempted from the bill. I thought that the nature of the hearings that they conduct being, for the most part, where the agency is deciding a dispute between two other parties, and it's not a matter of the agency enforcing its own rules directly against a regulated individual or business, made a good argument for exempting CCB and the Landscape Contractors Board out of the bill. That's one of those things that got left on the table, frankly. The governor's office drew a line in the sand, and I knew where that line was, and CCB got left on one side of that, and Mr. Lazenby can maybe address that. And I'm not here to argue for an amendment at this point that would take CCB out of the bill. I've made a commitment to the bill with these amendments, and I'm prepared to go forward with that.
Are you sure you don't want amendment number 25?
We already have one, actually. It's just that you'll notice that some of these numbers they don't follow one from the other. There is a CCB amendment in there somewhere, but it is not before you today as part of the package that the governor's office has agreed to support.
There's Representative Walker, there's an infinite possibility for amendments if we should open the door for this. Specifically in the case of CCD, we had extensive conversations with their representatives talking about the type of hearings that they were interested in having exempted from this bill. And if I may, let me just take a brief moment to explain the circumstances that they described to me they felt should be exempted from this bill. You have a situation where an individual such as Mr. Schumann has a kitchen addition or a new story put on his home, let's say. And he develops a series of disputes with this contractor. He can file a complaint with the board. The board at this point, and their practice, which I think is a good one, is that they dispatch an investigator who goes out and examines the site, and in conjunction with that, really performs a type of alternative dispute resolution. These are people that are knowledgeable, who understand the construction industry, and who will be able to look at, let's say, there were three or four basic items that were in controversy. And they would be able to look and say, this is unacceptable. This is something that will settle over time. This is something else. These two things over here that can be fixed and should be fixed relatively reasonably. Is this something that the parties can agree to? And my understanding is that a number of those complaints that are filed with the board are so resolved in the course of the year. Nothing in this bill changes that. The next step is if Mr. Schumann continues to be aggrieved, if he doesn't like the proposal that this trained inspector has really done, the citizen still has a right under the statute to ask for a hearing before the board. And as with every other state agency that's involved in this bill, what happens at that point is that there is an opportunity for a contested case hearing. And that would be set before a hearings officer. Nothing in this bill prevents that from happening at this point in time. That can still continue to occur. The hearings officer in that circumstance can still try to get the parties to come to reach some sort of agreement short of an order from the board before this ends up happening. But if the citizen decides that what they want to do is exercise their statutory right and proceed to a contested case hearing, they will go ahead. What the bill changes is that possibly in about 2 years, once the trainings and standards are in place, someone other than the people that have heard all of the Construction Contractors Board cases may end up being assigned by the Chief Hearings Officer to organize those facts and to make a record for the Construction Contractors Board to issue a final order. Now, I say if in 2 years, because if you look at the bill in terms of the standards and training, you will see that it's staggered in over a period of time. Everybody that's conducting contested case hearings now will continue to do so. The first charge of the Chief Hearings Officer is to develop standards and to develop a training program in the first year. It isn't until the end of the second year that the current hearings officers are required to complete that training. I think as a practical matter, members of this committee and the legislature can assume that there's not going to be a radical change in terms of the faces that you see in any particular area. So there are a number of concerns, and the Construction Contractors Board is not alone. There have been a number of agencies that have expressed concerns to me that I think really are based in more a fear of the unknown than any objective reality that's found in the text of the bill. And furthermore, Representative Walker, let me conclude by saying that when we talk about the perceptions of fairness and the perception of even-handedness and independence that the proponents of this bill are seeking, this is precisely the kind of situation where this is a valuable thing, where you can have somebody who's independent of the board, who's not someone that hears all the board's cases and understands the board's point of view, brokering a decision, but somebody that can be pointed to by the board and by others as being somebody that isn't connected with them, and they end up with a result that they can trust and rely upon.
Thank you.
Judy.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to follow up Representative Walker's question, she asked you why the Construction Contractors Board was not included on the exemptions. My question is, why was the unemployment claims included? I can look at all of the exemptions, and there's all, in my mind, a logical reason why you exempted them except for the unemployment claims, and I would be curious to know why.
I'm sorry, Representative.
Unemployment.
The unemployment claims were included in this?
As being exempted out.
My understanding from talking with the folks from employment, some of them are here to help you out, but as I recall from our work group discussions about inclusions and exclusions, there are some federal requirements in terms of timelines and in terms of requirements for those hearings on the unemployment claims that they felt that it was important that those be separated out. And since they were running the program, we're going to run this the entire central panel program, we defer to their judgment on that. I think you're going to end up with the same folks having this hearing. So
that was my question. Since they are running the program, I think they should be part of it. But I'm not going to add
that. It just occurred to me that they are in except for the appeals board. They have two levels in employment, one being the employment hearing level and the other being the employment appeal board. And they're...
Yes. It's also contemplated in some of these amendments as well that we've had folks that have approached us and said, well, look, we have a special category of cases that we hear that really aren't governed by federal law. There are some features of unemployment. Voc rehab is another one of those that is covered by federal law. And we'll see in the amendment that there are changes that point this pilot program towards state law. And our attempt there is to divorce this from those hearings that have federal requirements.
Other questions from the committee?
Yes.
President Wells.
Thank you. I like the -3 amendments because that was an issue of last session that I was concerned about, having set in Ways and Means on listening to the budgets of all of the health-related boards. And so in last session, we were looking at whether they were going to be required to use this panel rather than the boards themselves having the hearings. And so we addressed it last session. I noticed then, of course, we have -17 amendments. I remember last session when the Board of Medical Examiners came in, we had quite a list, and I was wondering, when you look at all of the exemptions that are here in Section 9 plus the proposed amendments, what percentage of hearings in state government are really going to be covered by this panel, when we start exempting everyone out, and when we look at the total number of contested case hearings that are held out there, do we have any idea to get kind of a perception on what's going on here?
Representative Wells, we can provide you with that information. During the work group, Mike Lincecum, who was our DAS liaison with this, conducted a survey of all of state agencies, and what we found is that there are two sort of large categories of hearings, one of which is included, one of which is excluded. If you look at corrections and parole and probation and some of the other law enforcement, psychiatric security review board, they have a substantial amount of these hearings. But since the concern really was the citizens, the at-large citizens interface with government, we felt that it was appropriate to keep those out. The other large chunk of those hearings that you find are in DHR, in OLCC, and in DMV, and through ODOT. So we think we've captured a lot of the bulk of the contested case hearings, and really the bulk of the contested case hearings where the majority of organizations do. But I can get you the data on that because we did do a survey that's based on, I think, last biennium's track record. And we don't expect that to vary over the course of this next biennium because of this legislation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, if I can just follow up on that. That's fine with me. There is, again, going back to 2948, it was actually a much smaller stable of agencies that would have been included in that bill. Being confident of the approach that this bill takes and looking at what has happened in other states that have gone down this road, my objective was to get at least a critical mass of agencies, enough agencies doing enough hearings to establish that this is a good process. And experience, again, in other states suggests that once you do that, agencies and constituents of agencies that are reluctant to get into this at the outset begin to contract with and move in voluntarily to this central panel just because it is, in other states, has worked so well. So we can look at this, all of us can look at this and at the exemptions and think, well, there's another agency that ought to be in to catch a few more hearings here or there. I think we've done enough, the objective being to capture enough hearings to demonstrate the viability of the panel just as a functioning entity. In brief answer, I'd say well over half the hearings.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, since you mentioned agencies and constituents of agencies may opt in and hire into the services, and I noticed in the list of agencies that were accepted were LUGA, do you contemplate that this act would take on local planning commission hearings and that sort of thing if the parent agency or the senior agency such as LUGA is accepted from this?
Thank you. That's Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe. That's something that I did not mention in my overview that we drafted into the bill. It actually does authorize the panel to contract with local governments to conduct their hearings on behalf of local governments. As you know, most local governments don't have their own hearing officers to conduct the cases for which they may need them. There's nothing that obviously we can require of local governments, but in that we are anticipating this bill will give rise to this new professional class of hearing officers, not to say that they're not professionals now, but that we're bringing everybody up on board. It will, I hope, be a resource that local governments will be wanting to use as well, and that, of course, will be a source of revenue then to the panel.
Other questions of this panel?
Well, thank you for your hard work being
you.
On the sidelines and watching this. I saw many drafts and many emails and letters. It was it's a persistence. So, Mr. Witness Chair, I'll let you return to your real chair. And the Senate Judiciary Committee is to convene at 4 o'clock to hear bills back in our regular room. So I'd ask our Senate members to leave right now. We have some out-of-state witnesses that will be.
Hello.
As soon as we can get the Senate members out of the room.
It's kind of nice being all cozy like this.
Hard to get them in.
Hard to get them out. That's right. I'd call at this time John DiLorenzo to come forward if you would. The chair will return in just a moment.
It is cozy like this. I like this.
I'm finally warm enough. Oh, please.
No, I think that it's the fact that the whole room has enough humanity.
Yeah, I think we're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Litigation Reform Coalition. I have distributed, and we're testifying in favor of House Bill 2525. I've distributed some fairly abbreviated testimony. I would like to, in light of Representative Shetterly's excellent overview, further abbreviate this, given the hour, and merely summarize the material that appears between pages 3 and 5 of the testimony. As many of you are aware, when parties appear before administrative hearings, they do have their fortunes and sometimes their careers on the line. Given the perception that there is a lack of separation between the person who is prosecuting the claim and the person who is deciding the case, it is not. It is certainly understanding that many people feel that the decks, that the cards are in the deck are stacked against them. And wouldn't you feel the same way if the party investigating and making a charge against you was also empowered to decide your fate? Of course, we would not tolerate that arrangement in the judicial system. Yet we have tolerated it in an administrative process. The Oregon Litigation Reform Coalition and 18 other organizations, for those reasons, were determined during the 1997 session to work to attempt to impart fairness and the appearance of it into the Administrative Procedures Act. Our solution in 1997 was House Bill 2948, which was adopted overwhelmingly and on a bipartisan basis that session. Frankly, the bill received 40 votes on concurrence in the House, 20 votes in the Senate. It would have received more than 20 votes had Senator Brown, who carried the bill, asked for a call of the Senate. So there were no votes in opposition to that bill on the Senate floor. In 1997, the bill contained four key components from our vantage point. First, it separated the adjudicatory function from the prosecutorial function by creating a central panel of hearings officers who were not directly employed by the agencies whose cases they decided. Secondly, the bill discouraged ex parte contacts, requiring hearings officers to place in the record the substance of all communications and allowing the opposing party to rebut the substance of those communications on the record. Third, the bill, this was 2948, restricted modification of hearings officers' findings of fact by an agency. And it recognized that although agencies do have special expertise in policy and application of the law to the facts, an agency has no special monopoly on the expertise required to actually decide the facts. House Bill 2948 prohibited altering findings of fact unless the agency could show that there was no substantial evidence in the record that supported the finding. And finally, with respect to judicial review, House Bill 2948 required an agency to clearly state its rationale from departing from either findings of fact or conclusions of law to allow a court to examine whether the agency could overcome its burdens. Well, as you've heard, unfortunately, the governor vetoed that bill, but fortunately, the governor did convene a task force to work during the interim to address the problem. As proponents of the original House Bill 2948, we are delighted that the chairs and the governor's office have been able to arrive at an accord. We are here today in support of House Bill 2525 and the agreed-upon amendments, including the Dash 23 amendment, because this bill adequately addresses those four main concerns which I outlined just moments ago. First, this bill ensures separation of roles between the prosecutors and the adjudicator by providing that independent hearings officers may not work for the agencies whose hearings they preside over. Second, this bill at Section 20 contains rules requiring disclosures of ex parte contacts and restrictions, which are so important to preserve fairness and the perception of it. Third, although this bill permits an agency to modify a hearings officer's findings, it does require the agency to identify the modifications, to provide an explanation of the party, to the parties for the hearing as to why the agency made the modifications, and it also provides that an agency may modify a finding of historical fact only if the agency determines that the finding of historical fact made by the hearings officer is not supported by a preponderance of evidence in the record. The bill is amended that finds a finding of historical fact, and this is per the Dash 23 amendments, as a determination that an event did or did not occur in the past, or that a circumstance or status did or did not exist either before the hearing or at the time of the hearing. And finally, the printed bill, as modified by the Dash 23 amendments, provides for meaningful judicial review, the fourth major point that we were interested in the original bill last session. If a party seeks judicial review of the agency's modification of a finding of historical fact, the Court of Appeals is instructed to make an independent finding of the fact in dispute by conducting a review de novo of the record viewed as a whole. In other words, the court looks at the entire record and may substitute its judgment for that of the agency on that particular point.
If the court decides that an agency erred in modifying the finding of historical fact by the hearings officer, the court must remand the matter back to the agency for an entry of an order consistent with the court's judgment. All in all, House Bill 2525 represents, in our view, a great accomplishment. It ensures separation of roles, restrictions on ex-party communications, prohibition of alterations of findings of historical fact unless they are not supported by a preponderance of the evidence, and it imparts fairness and reciprocity on judicial review. It is, in my view, a brilliant compromise for which the chairs and the members of this committee and all who participated in the negotiation of its terms may fairly take credit and should certainly be proud. Mr. Chairman, if I may just for a moment depart once again, I think there are a number of people in the audience here who deserve some recognition for this bill, and I'd like to take just a moment to acknowledge some of them. I think special thanks should go to David Marcus and Janice Krem, who spent hours and hours and hours of their personal time providing tremendous technical expertise to all of the parties who were involved in not only 2948, but the year and a half of negotiations that led up to what is a marvelous compromise. I also would like to acknowledge David Schuman, Chip Lazenby, and Senator Kate Brown. David and Chip for the roles you know they played, Senator Brown for having carried 2948 on the floor of the Senate during the last session of the legislature. That group in particular is are folks with whom I quite often find I disagree with on policy terms, but one thing is for certain, I have, with respect to each of them, a tremendous personal regard for them, not only with respect to their abilities, but their integrity, and I think this is an example of how when persons respect one another, their disagreements in other areas never interfere with their ability to combine when they do feel that there is a good policy to pursue. And I think they deserve great acknowledgement. I also think that Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council deserves great acknowledgement. He has, since 1995, been providing excellent legal advice, again, to all of the parties, drafting and redrafting and redrafting. I cannot think of how many iterations of this bill and its predecessor. Certainly Representative Williams deserves special recognition for getting involved in this issue as early as 1995 when he was legal counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Bryant for recognizing as early as 1995 a need to pursue this. And last but not least, especially Mr. Chairman, you for having made this issue not only one of your take-home issues, but basically committing many, many waking moments and probably and dreaming about
sleeping
it,
moments,
probably
to
sleeping
right
moments to this bill. I think you have all done a tremendous job. Again, I feel this is a brilliant compromise. Everybody didn't get everything they wanted, but it is a marvelous step in the direction of creating not only fairness, but the perception of it, something that is so very important to our process. Thank you.
I appreciate your comments. Any questions from Mr. Lorenzo? For the record, the chair wants to thank Representative Edwards, too, for whatever you've done. Now will you vote for the thing? He was left on the list.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate that. Do we have any comments or questions for John? Okay. Thanks very much.
Good thank you.
Janice Krem.
Thank you.
Representative Williams, Judiciary Committee members, my name is Janice Krem, and I urge you today to support House Bill 2525. I speak from my perspective as a former manager of an agency's hearings division. as a hearing officer and as a lawyer representing Oregonians before a large number of this state's regulatory agencies. HB 2525, I believe, establishes a good balance for our administrative hearing system. It remedies many of the real and perceived problems with our current system. It also keeps what is good about the current system. This bill continues to ensure that agencies set policy, not hearing officers. Unless it chooses otherwise, the agency still makes the final decision in an administrative hearing. At the same time, HB 2525 enhances the hearing officer's ability to conduct an impartial hearing and create an impartial record. For the public, it is impossible to believe that a hearing officer can be impartial when working for the agency that is prosecuting the case. Consequently, having hearing officers work for a separate hearing panel rather than the prosecuting agency is an important aspect of ensuring the impartiality of the hearing process. Likewise, controlling ex parte communication ensures that an impartial decision is made. Secret discussions between hearing officers and agency staff can no longer occur, at least in the cases that are heard by the hearing panel. Information that an agency wants to convey to a hearing officer must be presented openly on the record. With HB 2525, agency staff prosecuting the case can no longer be using the back door to the hearing officer. HB 2525 also protects the findings of historical fact. In a hearing, it is the hearing officer who actually hears the witness's testimony, watches the witness's expression and body language. This testimony forms the hearing officer's opinion as how to weigh the evidence. These kinds of determinations by an impartial hearing officer should be respected. An agency looking at a cold record is in no better a position to make findings of historical fact than a court is on appeal. If an agency wants to change a proposed order written by an impartial hearing officer, HB 2525 simply requires that the agency explain why. Besides enhancing the impartiality of the process, HB 2525 provides, I believe, a more cost-effective and efficient way of delivering administrative hearings. Having trained professionals conduct hearings means better hearings. An ethics code is an important part of ensuring that a hearing officer meets professional standards. HB 2525 provides both training and professional standards for hearing officers, at least in this panel. This bill consolidates hearing services of many agencies into one existing agency without sacrificing expertise in conducting hearings. Consequently, HB 2525 should reduce hearing costs and streamline the administration of Oregon's administrative hearing system. Agencies experience peaks and valleys in their caseloads. With HB 2525, a pool of trained officers can easily meet these shifting agency needs. A hearing officer traveling some distance to conduct a hearing for one agency could conduct hearings in the area for other agencies. Not to be overlooked is the efficiency to be gained by having standardized rules of procedure for hearings. Currently, it is daunting to try to ascertain what hearing procedures are in effect for each agency. Some agencies have adopted the current version of the model rules. Some agencies are using former versions of the model rules. One agency is actually using the 1986 version of the model rules. With the assistance of the Attorney General, HB 2525 would standardize how hearings are conducted in Oregon. From my perspective as a hearing officer, as an administrator of a hearings program, as an attorney practicing administrative law, HB 2525 greatly improves administrative hearings in Oregon. I urge the passage of HB 2525.
Thank you for your testimony.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I do want to thank Ms. Krem for not only her testimony but her work on this bill through the interim. And I think it's helpful, frankly, for members of the committee who might not know your background, Janice, if you just maybe briefly tell us what you did before you went out into the private practice and are doing what you're doing now.
When I was at law school, I worked with some agencies just as a technical person and became impressed with the way I thought government handled dispute resolution. And although I was a trial lawyer, when I first got out of law school, I found that the concept of delivering fair hearings to the public was something that interested me as an alternative dispute resolution process. I was a hearing officer at the Department of Revenue. I was the chief administrative law judge at the OLCC. We conducted hearings not only for the OLCC, but for other agencies. And it became apparent to me that a panel was a good idea, especially since I had a lot of contact with other people in other states who had adopted a panel approach. I implemented many of the things in House Bill 2525 when I administered the hearing program at the OLCC. I know a lot of these concepts can work. What you need is a process that is required so that the standards that this bill provides for hearings is not something that can change administrator to administrator, but that is established as a constant part of a good hearing program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for the question. All right. Thank you, Ms. Krem. Let's bring up, I'm sorry, Representative Lowe. You have a question?
Thank you kindly. I noticed you may not be the appropriate witness to ask this of, but you're handy and you're knowledgeable, so I'll ask if that's all right.
Sure it is.
Amendment 21, it says that a chief hearing officer employed under Section 4 of this Act may temporarily exempt particular agencies or particular categories of hearings conducted by agencies from the application of Section 11. I'm trying to wait for this to flip back and forth. And
I can answer that very succinctly. Section 11 is part of the bill that says that that a party or an agency, either one, can request to have a different hearing officer assigned to the case. It's kind of like recusal of a judge. What we found, though, in working with the work group to put this together, I think it was the Department of Transportation in particular, said that caused some problems for the way their hearings are conducted, where they'll send out a hearing officer on a road trip around the state, and that hearing officer may not have their Thursday hearing scheduled until Tuesday, and they're out on the road on Monday. And so it became problematic as to how to implement that if the hearing officer is out on the road and heading down to Coquille for some hearings, and the request for a change doesn't come in until the day before the hearing, and how do you send somebody else out on the road? So without knowing exactly how to do that, rather than delete the provisions for requesting a change of hearing officer from the bill, it was decided the best thing to do would be to give the chief hearing officer some leeway in terms of phasing in those requirements where they're just difficult to implement. Okay.
Well, does that go swing both ways? Is there a way for an agency, for example, Teacher Standards Practice Commission may not want to have their hearings done by this agency, or they may want to have a different?
That actually is the -7 amendments. That makes the door swing both ways. So either the agency or a party can request a different hearing officer.
Who is the ultimate arbiter of that? Who decides?
Well, ultimately it'd be the chief hearing officer making the assignments. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's bring up Kathleen Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. The board has responsibility for the licensing, investigating, and disciplining of physicians and other healthcare professionals in the state of Oregon. I would like to just take a couple of moments and address my remarks to the -17 amendments. And those are amendments that I want to thank Chair Shetterly for being responsive to our needs relative to the issue of depositions. We just got a copy of it recently, and I don't want to derail this bill in any way, but I do want to bring to your attention that it does present a problem for a board such as ours, because it will extend the time if a deposition was allowed. For example, if you have a quality of care case and a physician says, I will pay for the depositions, the agency doesn't have to pay for the depositions, then the licensee could have depositions. Let's say they wanted to take a deposition of our medical expert, and we wanted to do the same for them. Under this provision, we could not do that. And so what we would like to see is that in our requested amendment, -17, that it end at the word deposition, that there be a period there, and that it not be related to the cost issue. And I have spoken with Mr. Lazenby, who is fine with this suggestion, and I realize that it might be more appropriate for us to bring it on the Senate sign, and we're more than willing to do that. But I just wanted to make our desires known at this time, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Ms. Haley and I have had conversation about this. This is one of those, this is like a game of pickup sticks, and this is one of those pieces that is part of the game as well. And I guess I would just point out that the -17 amendments were drafted on March 30 and have been in circulation. I understand you may not have seen them, but certainly they've been in circulation and, in fact, are part of the delegate compromise that that is referred to even in the governor's, Mr. Lazenby's letter as meeting the governor's requirements. What this addresses is that the agency cannot be forced to pay for a deposition, but I think especially in cases that are fact-dependent, it is actually, in my mind anyway, it enhances fairness of the process to allow some deposition, especially if you're talking about a case, let's say a critical case like a licensing proceeding where a physician or a dentist may be looking at loss of their ability to practice. And what this recognizes is that they would have the right to take a deposition to better prepare themselves for a hearing, albeit not at the agency's expense if it's going to be their deposition. With respect to the impact of this on timeliness and how long a proceeding can take, will this element of it string the timeline out? I think that can best be dealt with by the rules that the chief hearing officer would adopt for the timeline for these things. I mean, that's going to be part of, I think, what the chief hearing officer is going to be able to say. If you want a deposition, it's got to happen within this time frame. But in cases like this, where we've got somebody in the BME in particular, a doctor who's looking at the prospect of losing their livelihood in an administrative proceeding, I don't have any problem with the ability for that doctor to undertake some meaningful discovery before they get to that day of reckoning. Before the agency. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
John Mangus. Mr. Mangus, this is new. It's a check mark in the against with a question mark.
That's right, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Mangus. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I came in here in the sign-up sheet, you know, and you could be for, you could be against, or you could be neutral, and I didn't think I was neutral, but I didn't want to be against it since it had the governor's name on it, so I put a question mark.
Well chosen.
Yeah. I am here to request that the Department of Veterans Affairs be one of those agencies, and I'm sure you'll hear from many of them, be excluded from the hearings officer process. I've passed out some information there, most of it's provided by the Attorney General's office, but also our bond counsel at Ader Wynn. Because of the uniqueness of the Oregon Veterans Home Loan program and the responsibilities under Article 11A and Chapter 407 and the Internal Revenue Code on which the bonds were issued. They have all suggested that either we be excluded or at least that program under Chapter 407 be added to the exclusion. As far as hearings at the Department of Veterans Affairs, in the last 3 years, we've had roughly 24 informal hearings, and only 6 of them have gone forward to a contested case hearing. The 3 of those were dropped, and 1 of them has gone on to the Court of Appeals. I think about the back door getting to a hearings officer, I don't think I've ever done that, because we've tried to suggest to these people how they can correct that mistake legally at very little cost to them and more or less right their ship. That's basically all I wanted to say. There's one provision in the bill that would create us a problem, and that was directed at the budgeting portion of the hearings panel when it's created, and it looked like the chief hearings officer gathers up all the information of costs and then turns around and provides an assessment to the participating agencies. And there is an attorney general's opinion that has been issued a couple of years ago on assessments of a fund separate, like the Oregon War Veterans Fund, where they can't make an assessment. So even with the Secretary of State and the Division of Audits, they no longer assess us. We do it on time and charges, actual costs. And we pay roughly right now $308 for each contested case hearing that we do have, and that's relatively cheap.
Thanks. I guess I would just respond. I know that your letter, your counsel's letter, did come in and was reviewed by Mr. Lazenby and Mr. Schumann and myself and others in the work group, and determined that inclusion of the DVA in the agency for the purpose of contested case hearings would not be fatal to the types of hearings that you conduct. And so at that point, I guess on that, it was determined that we would go ahead and leave DVA in. And as to the funding piece, I think we'll just make some testimony about that, although I will say that this bill has a referral to Ways and Means, and frankly, I'm happy to let that get dealt with down there if there's an issue as far as funding goes. Okay. Thanks very much. Well, the next one, General, I have a big bold X on this one. Yeah, this is good. Everyone's kind of expressing their feelings about this bill and how they sound. Come on forward, and John Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I was looking for a column that talked about feeling revulsion, and I couldn't find it. As of last legislative session, the Oregon Association of Realtors is advocating being excluded from this bill, and my written testimony is being handed out right now. I wanted to go over that briefly with you, but also make some additional points, if I may. The Oregon Association of Realtors, several sessions back, was instrumental in bringing about legislation that required the real estate commissioner to come from the real estate background, and we did that for a reason. We believe that under House Bill 2525, an individual, a licensee defending themselves before a panel would incur additional costs because they would have to bring someone in with experience in the real estate profession. Now, House Bill 2525, if you look on page 2, section 7, it talks about whenever practicable, assign a hearings officer that has expertise in legal issues. It doesn't say always, and it doesn't say what level of care they're going to do to ensure that an individual has knowledge of the real estate profession. It may indicate that individual has knowledge of real estate law, but even if there is knowledge of real estate law, that does not mean that the person has been out in the trenches putting together a real estate transaction and is knowledgeable about what is common practice among real estate professionals. I testified before the Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government on January 28th of this legislative session in support of Senate Bill 5534, which was the real estate agency's budget at that time, the real estate commissioner was accompanied by a fiscal officer who indicated that there would be additional negative impacts should House Bill 2525 be passed. At that time, there was the individuals on the panel were not sure what House Bill 2525 was, and I took the opportunity to give them just a brief overview, and they were really shocked that a negative fiscal impact would be brought about on the real estate agency, when to their knowledge no one had complained about the process of the current commissioner as chief hearings officer. They asked me to justify why it was that the real estate agency was being included in such a bill, and I told them that I could give them no justification since, to my knowledge, none of my members have ever complained about the commissioner or the process.
Well, I guess I can answer that in brief. The real estate agency is in the bill because when the governor's office drew up the list of boards, commissions, and agencies that they wanted included in the bill, it contained the real estate agency.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. One of the previous speakers indicated that the primary reason that individual licensees or agencies did not want to be included in the bill was more a fear of the unknown rather than by objective reality. And to us, money is a very objective reality. And this bill, while the fiscal officer that accompanied the commissioner to the Ways and Means hearing could not, when asked directly what the additional cost would be to the agency, was unable to give a specific cost. However, under last session's bill, there would have been an unbudgeted $263,500. And again, no one has presented information about what it would cost the agency this time around. We believe it would cost the agency additional funds. We believe it would cost the individual trying to defend themselves additional funds. It's another, if you will, let the realtor pay bill. We just heard a bill over on the Senate side in Judiciary where there was a mechanism to allow unpaid debts under $3,000 to follow a property. If I incurred a debt, if I didn't pay my credit card and then sold my house to John, that bill would allow the debt to go with the house, and it would be John's responsibility to pay the bill, or else it could be in his home. We brought that up to the committee. We testified how we felt that was unfair, how many times such a debt would not be identified in time, and the response from the committee at that time was, well, let the realtor pay, and that seems to be the attitude with this bill as well. If you want to defend yourself and bring in expert testimony, you'll have to pay for it. To my knowledge, no one spoke with any representatives of our association, no one spoke with any of our members. As I said, none of our members have complained about the current process. In closing, I would just suggest that the real estate agency be included in Section 9, as are a number of other committees. There will also be a duplication of the process, since the real estate commissioner and the agency will carry the hearing up to a certain point, and then it will be turned over to the administrative law judge panel, and they will have to start from the beginning. One of the things my written testimony has indicated that I didn't want to belabor, but I think is common knowledge among our profession, and I think everyone in the legislature as well, is that our commissioner has been very, very good about keeping an arm's length relationship, because he is the chief hearings officer in any case. And I have seen, in fact, in this room, people approach him when he came in to testify on another matter, and I've seen individuals come in and say, I want to talk to you about this case, and he said, I'm sorry, I cannot speak with you about that because I'm the chief hearings officer, and I'll hear it when it's my turn to hear it, and I can't discuss it beforehand. So again, there is no problem currently with the real estate agency. There is no problem among the licensees. Nobody is complaining. We would ask that you include the real estate agency in the list of exemptions. With me today is our president, John Baker, who has a few comments to make as well.
Baker.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted you, members of the committee, to actually see somebody that is affected by this bill. I am a licensee. I'm not a lobbyist. And I'm opposed to this bill because when you're talking about, based on the expert testimony that you've heard so far prior to us coming up here, it was obvious to me that there's a clear lack of understanding of how the real estate agency operates. I'm involved right now. I'm going to be an expert witness in a case against the licensee here in a week and a half. The staff who is investigating it gave me specific instructions that I could have no conversation whatsoever with the commissioner. The commissioner, by background, has had 2 decades field experience being an agent and a broker in our field, has won every or earned every significant award that our industry has given or recognizes an individual for. He's graduate of the National Judicial College. He's been involved in education, going around the state, doing classes on the latest things going on in our industry. And if someone has an action against me, they would file an issue and the staff person would investigate. They would talk to me and maybe there would be a resolution at that point in time. But if they want to go farther, then I'm going to be, my license is on the line. And most of the cases that you've heard described so far, if something goes against the agency, hey, they have their job the next day. But my job's on the line. And I don't want to have my license on the line in front of some tin horn that has no knowledge about our industry. You know, one of the nice things about the way we've got it now is there's a build up of experience. Every time the commissioner hears a hearing, there's a gaining of experience there. And that's something that we would lose. We would need to educate every person that comes in. And I'd like to ask a question of those on the panel. How many of you know the difference between innocent misrepresentation and negligent misrepresentation as it relates to real estate? How many know the difference in that?
Well, let me respond, I guess, in this way, Mr. Baker, that is going to be an ultimate determination under this bill. The bill is going to reside in the directors. The hearing officer is going to be finding facts. Whether those facts dictate a conclusion that a misrepresentation was innocent or not is still going to reside within the purview of the agency. That's not what this bill gets at, and it doesn't. I don't think it does violence to that concern.
Well, obviously, no one knew the answer to that question, and so the thing is that do we need to provide a 90-minute tape, which I'm going to submit to this committee on misrepresentation. That's one of the most common complaints against real estate licensees. Do we need to give that to the hearings officers so they can get educated on what misrepresentation is related to real estate, or should the public be best served by the person that produced this, which is the real estate commissioner, and distributed this statewide to the licensees, be hearing the case? I'm going to submit this. I would like it if you'd take some time to read that. It talks about case law and everything that the common hearings officer is not going to have when they come on. So I also wanted to comment on a couple things. There is that separation. They're talking about there's no separation here. The real estate commissioner is separate from staff. There's no contact in between. And as far as the cost savings, how can there be a cost savings when we've got a hearings officer coming in and the commissioner's still there? That's a bogus argument. That is a bogus argument. And with that, I would like to ask you to exclude the real estate agency from include us in Section 9. Thank you very much.
I'll just respond very briefly, and I want to move on with the witnesses. Number one, when this bill was up before this committee 2 years ago, it was 2948, and also in the consideration of the work group, we heard from Justice Nick Gillette, who was not able to make it here today, who spoke expressly about the issue of expertise. When Justice Gillette was the Solicitor General, he was in the Department of Justice and actually opposed to an earlier iteration of this bill. Since then, he has had something of a change of heart and strongly favors a panel such as this and loves to hold forth on the issue of expertise. And his point is that hearing officer's function is to determine facts, and you don't need to be an expert to determine what the facts were. The facts are the facts. And an agency shouldn't have a particular bent or a sense that it has ownership of what the facts are in the case, but that's what a hearing officer is to determine. And then the application of the policy or the law to those facts, again, will reside, continue to reside in this bill, in the agency. You also obviously have a good relationship with the director of your agency, of the real estate agency, and I think that's great. It sounds like there's a good process. But I would go back to what Ms. Krim said. This bill addresses an institutional issue. I don't think it's in the best interest of government to be dependent on the good faith or the goodwill of the various directors of agencies to provide the process. We have an opportunity here to institutionalize a process across the board that will affect everybody. So if I'm that dentist or the doctor coming down to protect my license or the realtor, and if I have the sense that I might or might not get a fair hearing from that director who has already issued some at least initial action against me, I would rather have fairness than expertise. And fairness, I think, is what this bill is about. Again, you don't need to be the expert to find out what the facts are. I just that Gillette harps on that, and I will today in his absence, but I think that's a fundamental issue about a bill like this. We are talking about hearing officers whose job it will be to collect, to determine facts, to present to the agency, to present to the director, to make ultimately the final decision, unless the agency on its own delegates to the hearing officer the authority under a final order.
Well, essentially, I'd be spending my attorney's time in the hearings officer so that they can watch this to get the expertise. And also, I'd like to comment that I did sell Justice Gillette his home, so thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Chairman,
yeah.
I have a question of you. How about the Oregon State Bar hearings?
It's a different judicial branch. That's what it was. Yeah, they're a member of the judicial branch.
So we don't have to do that.
Right, they're not part of the administrative. Yeah, that's right. Judicial
branch. Just wanted that on the record. Thank you.
Steve Delaney.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. My name is Steve Delaney. I'm the manager of the Government Relations Administrative Law Section of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System. We're just here. We are neutral with regard to Senate Bill 2525, but did want to point out our concern. In the testimony that I've provided, which may not be handed out at the moment, I've included, as an example, the current resume of the independent hearings officer, whose services PERS uses right now. The gentleman is an extreme expert when it comes to retirement pension. It is important to PERS because of our tax qualification. State law is an issue that, of course, is being considered in an appeal, but the impact that a decision can have under state law has to be considered with regard also to the federal level laws. So we may make a decision of fact under state law, yet if those facts contradict the federal law and requirements for a trust fund, then that also has to be taken into consideration. And that's where we look to the expertise of our hearings officer. PERS goes to great lengths to search out a hearings officer with sufficient expertise to be able to handle our cases. We try to maintain these as long as possible. Our normal relationship is 3 to 4 years at a time with the hearings officer before they were to move on to some other project. Our point here is, again, neutral as far as the bill. What we would like to see is something in the bill that would indicate that there would not be, as provided in Section 7, the probability of hearings officers changing from one hearing to the other. We would be in support of a hearings officer on the panel being assigned to a particular type of case and that same hearings officer continuing with the department through the years, so that there is that building of expertise within the panel that could handle these cases. Just want to bring that to your attention, Arthur.
I appreciate that. And I think, in fact, the directive in Section 7 is that the chief hearing officer shall, whenever practicable, assign a hearing officer that has expertise. So I think that was intended to solve those concerns. Also, pointing out that the chief hearing officer does have the authority to contract out in cases where panel may not have the expertise to, or for whatever reason, may not be able to conduct a hearing. And so on a case-by-case basis, if a case is made that somebody outside the panel is needed for whatever purpose, chief hearing officer does have the authority to go outside the panel and bring somebody in on a difficult, complex case. Thank you. Maureen Bach.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Maureen Bach. I'm the chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. And I'm here today to support House Bill 2525 and...
Thank you. Any questions?
I'm going to be very brief. And you notice I have no written testimony. I will not give you any more paper. I'm here today to propose a minor amendment to House Bill 2525, and that was the -19s that are not included in your packet. And what that would have done is include our crime victims compensation hearings that is part of the jurisdiction that the board has. The Work Comp Board is an independent agency within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We do not have an administrative or regulatory function. Rather, all we do is conduct hearings on matters concerning a claim under Chapter 656. We conduct four OSHA hearings under the Oregon Safe Employment Act, and we oversee the hearings division that conducts those hearings. They are independent, and we like to stress that in particular. We also are then the appellate body that reviews their final orders. We do that on a de novo standard of review. Among our other duties, the board conducts hearings on appeals from the Oregon Department of Justice decisions regarding applications for compensation in the Crime Victims Assistance Program, which is Chapter 147, and that is the one that we would like to see included. I have told the governor's office and Representative Shetterly that I think since we haven't done any of these hearings in the last 2 years, this is not something that is a major amendment and certainly would not be a bill killer if I was sitting in your position. But having said that, I thought I should come forward and at least bring that to your attention.
Okay, so for the committee's information, the -19s, which you don't, which you have not, do not have in front of you, if you would turn to page 3 of the bill, on line 15, where it says Workers' Compensation Board with respect to hearings under ORS chapters, the -19s would insert 147
right
there. You're telling us that those are the crime victims?
Right.
Hearings of which you have not had any?
Right. In 2 years.
In the last 2 years. Okay. Okay. We'll take that into consideration.
Thank you.
Jane Myers.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers. I represent the Oregon Dental Association. I did want to say, and I realize we put a cross in the neutral column and leaning towards opposing, but I wanted to give you just a little history on the record since this is a pilot project and it looks like the bill is going to move, that the dentists are fee payers. Their fees entirely support the Board of Dentistry, so in that regard, the fee payers are kind of like taxpayers, and they want to make sure they have an efficiently run agency. In the past, the last session, we opposed the bill because we thought there was some arbitrariness about which agencies were included. We're happier that it seems to include more of the agencies, and at least we haven't seen amendments to allow out a whole lot of the agencies.
Is this the Misery Loves Company?
Yes,
the
Misery,
okay.
Exactly. we are concerned about the impact on the Board of Dentistry's expertise, and we're not familiar with historical facts, and we see that as a new concept. In the time that it's a pilot project, we'll be looking at that too. The concern is that the dentists are not comfortable with it because it might lower the standard of care expected from healthcare professionals. And an example of that might be, does the x-ray show what the hearing officer thinks it shows, or does it show what the Board of Dentistry thinks it shows, and some disputes about making judgments about x-ray, which a lot of diagnosis for dental work is based on, could come up. On the back of the printed testimony I gave you, one of the senators on the Ways and Means Committee asked us if our members supported the Board of Dentistry's budget, and in trying to figure out if we had some support, this is the way our members ranked five bills that have to do with issues that are directly related to dentistry, and this particular bill did not rank very well. The one that did rank the highest besides the Board of Dentistry's budget, which our members did approve with an over 20% increase, is the money that they'd like to see spent for OHSU Pediatric Dental Residency Program. So that's for some history. We'll be probably be back in 2005, I guess, or 4, whenever it is.
Jane, just may comment just a couple of things as to the standard of care issue and the question of who reads the x-ray, I guess, the hearing officer or the agency. The Dash 12 amendments Dash 16 amendments make it clear that agencies are entitled to use their specialized knowledge in making decisions on final orders in a proceeding. And again, the distinction between the historical facts and an inference drawn from facts, I think it will not be the case that the hearing officer will be determining whether a dentist exercised a standard of care. They may be determining whether the x-ray was taken and on what date and those kinds of things, but the standard of care issues, I think, are clearly within the specialized knowledge of the agency and would be reserved to the agency under the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to hear that the Dash 16, I just received those today. I'll
okay.
Yeah. Close to look at them.
But they were actually proposed by the Attorney General to address that kind of issue. Okay. Thank you. A couple more here. Fred Van Natta. Oh, and while Fred is getting settled, pointed out to me that the question about the crime victims hearings in the Dash 19 amendments actually is resolved in the Dash 20 amendments. The change that the Dash 19 amendments would have made is also made in the Dash 20, so that issue is taken care of. Fred.
I am Fred Bonato, appearing before you today on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association. And we're, I guess, on the list of people that are seeking at least a partial exemption from this act. And let me give you a quick history and point out to you where we're headed and the reasons for it. When the Construction Contractors Board was created, it was created to provide a speedy and inexpensive dispute resolution process. Because prior to that, essentially you hired an attorney. Over the last 25 years, the board has worked out, frankly, a pretty good dispute resolution process. And here is where this board differs from some of the others you've heard. 90% of the cases and the ones we're specifically talking about are the two-party cases where there's a dispute between the contractor and the customer. Now, the disciplinary cases, which is what this bill essentially is addressed towards, we have no objections to including those in the act. And frankly, I believe it's generally a good idea to have an independent panel make the decisions where the Construction Contractors Board calls up a contractor and says, thou has not done something you should have done or thou has done wrong and we want to discipline you. We're very happy to have that done through the auspices of this legislation. The cases that we are talking about are what we refer to as the two-party cases. And in that sense, the Construction Contractors Board is fairly unique in state service and fairly unique in the coverage under this legislation. Now, the I worked with at least some of the proponents of this legislation back in 95 and 96 when we prepared the prior bill, and the entire discussion we had then was where the agency made the rules, issued the called the licensee before them, and was the judge and the jury. And we thought that was a good idea to set that out to an independent hearing. Never was any discussion, and the case has never been made, that the two-party disputes of the Construction Contractors Board would be improved by the process talked about under this bill. And in fact, the 97 version of this bill specifically excluded the Construction Contractors Board. We don't think these two-party disputes should be brought into this process. Don't fix something that isn't broke. Just because we seem to have developed a system that's working doesn't mean the legislature should now tinker with it. When the permanent staff of a legislative, of administrative law judges that currently are working for the Construction Contractors Board were hired, certified training in mediation was established as a critical criteria. Now a growing percentage of these two-party disputes are resolved by resolved in mediation by the ALJ without a contested case hearing. This frequently occurs even after the case has been assigned to an ALJ. Since the legislature authorized the Construction Contractors Board to engage in binding arbitration with the consent of the parties, their ALJs provide that service as well. This arbitration authority is generally unique to the CCB. Your randomly selected hearing officers under this system, under the system contemplated in this bill, are unlikely to be skilled in those areas. And finally, there's the question of cost. If House Bill 2525 is approved as drafted, it would add up about $468,000 to the CCB budget. That money will either have to come from a drawdown in reserves or an increase in the registration fee of more than 10% for the biennium. This bill, as it applies to this agency, is neither less government nor better government. It's true the fiscal impact can be ameliorated by not removing all six employees as Section 17 requires, but still, the cost will be well over $100,000 of added cost to the contractors to fix a system that isn't broken. For my part, I'm not prepared to go to my clients and explain to them that they will have the pleasure of paying an extra $100,000 to change a system that isn't broken. I recognize the governor's office has taken a dogmatic position on the issue of including the two-party cases of the Construction Contractors Board, and I have been puzzled as to why. We've had repeated meetings with them, and they have never once said the system of two-party cases, dispute resolution was broken. There's never been an example. Our members follow that very closely, and frankly, a lot of them are involved in it, and they do not argue that the system of dispute resolution, mediation, arbitration, and finally a hearing before a hearings officer is a system that's broken or needs to be brought into this system. Notwithstanding the opposition of the governor's office, Mr. Chairman, and committee members, we respectfully ask you to delete the customer contractor dispute resolutions from this bill. Without that amendment, we will be in opposition to the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Fred, you and I have been through this before with Chip Lazenby in the conversation, so I think I've already said that I don't have any opposition to what you are asking, except that the governor has drawn the line in the sand, and so that puts me in a position of choosing between CCB or the bill, and you know where I come down on that. So again, my head and my heart are with you. But my commitment to the bill is stronger at this point for the general overall good that it does system-wide.
Yep. Mr. Chair, if I may respond, I appreciate having your head in your heart.
You want my
right at the moment, your vote is a little more important.
Right. No. I chose that.
But I think it's fair to observe, particularly when the governor's office makes no case as to why these specific two-party decisions ought to be brought into the process. It's inconceivable to me that he could veto the bill based on the removal of those two-party cases. He would at least then have to come up with some reason as to why the two-party cases ought to be in the bill if he was going to veto it, simply on that reason. So I doubt if that decision, if he drew the wall based on the merits of the issue before us today, either the threat to veto was based on some other set of criteria or concerns rather than the merits of the issue, is my guess.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Williams.
I'd just say that somehow the words inconceivable and governor's veto,
yeah,
somehow, these days I'm not sure mean much, Fred, and I don't know how to juxtapose those two phrases, but I think they've been very clear about where they say they'll come down on this, and I, like Representative Shetterly, would simply tell you that I've had actual experience representing parties who have had claims against builders who've gone through this process, and to the greatest extent, you know, there's always, you know, minor, you know, differences of opinion, but to the greatest extent, I think the process has worked relatively well, and I would tend to agree with you, but, you know, we're in the situation where we're having to accept something, I think, frankly, that isn't as good as we'd like it to be, but is doing, in general, better than we've currently got.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Of last two, Becky Osborne and Annette Talbot. They're going to tell us how this can work. Briefly.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. With me is Becky Osborne from the Hearings Division. We are primarily here to answer questions. Becky has been working with Representative Shetterly and Mr. Lazenby for over a year or so now on this. And so we can give you some of the information, although not quite sure if how detailed you'd like us to get on some of the staffing issues on this, or whether you'd preserve those and let them be discussed down in Ways and Means.
I think that's for the staffing issues, we can wait for Ways and Means to deal with.
So otherwise we're really here for basically for questions, as we've been given the privilege of housing these new staff, and we will certainly work hard to administer the program, and believe that the way that the bill is set up is something that we can certainly do that with.
Without, again, getting into detail, I guess, your testimony would be to the effect that technically the bill can be made to work in the employment division.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, members, the way that the bill is set up, we have worked hard to, with the addition of the amendments as set out in the memo to you from Mr. Hendricks, believe that we can make the bill work. We believe there may be one or two other technical amendments that we've talked to David Hendricks about from Legislative Council, but they can pick up on the other side if you're interested in getting this moving along, as I understand you are.
Yeah, which we are.
At the risk of getting Mr. Van Adam at me, I do believe that there are other agencies in there that do have two-party hearings, like premium audits at Workers' Comp Division and other things that are similar to his, that probably would have the same concerns that he does in terms of that there are only two-party hearings.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hi.
Hi.
What about the concern, and I think very valid concern, that some of the agencies have brought up regarding the need for true technical expertise, such as in the realtors and teachers, and I think Dennis and...
Maybe you could speak to the range of hearings that Employment already does on a contract.
I believe that Becky Osborne could do that. We do contract now for hearings for lots of other agencies.
For the record, my name is Becky Osborne. I'm with the Employment Department Hearing Section.
And yes, Chair Shetterly and Representative Lowe, we do quite a variety of different cases. We have a rather high volume in our unemployment cases, and we do a lot of cases for support in the division as well. Those are sort of our standard diet. But then we also have other agencies, for instance, a lot of the health division licensing boards, the veterinary board, the chiropractic examiners. I have quite a list. I think we have about maybe 12 or 15 different smaller agencies that don't have their own hearings officers for whom we do cases. And what we have found is that the hearings officer, I believe, as Chair Shetterly said before, goes in and makes a record, and it's the party's obligation as well as the hearings officer's to make a thorough record of the facts, and then the hearings officer will make those findings of fact. Whether or not the agency final order signer will agree with those and apply the law in the same way is a different issue. So there's ample opportunity for that agency expertise to be gathered and applied. The other thing I would say is it's incumbent on the hearings officer and the parties to make the record that would go up on any further appeal that might occur, such as through the Court of Appeals and beyond that to the Supreme Court. And it's putting the facts into the record and how it's going to be reviewed. And I don't know that each individual judge along the way up the appellate level would have any more expertise along the way either. So I guess my point is to echo Representative Shetterly that it is a matter of finding facts, and the expertise would be applied if perhaps the hearings officer needed some. The proposed order by the hearings officer was not appropriately correct. That could be addressed by the expertise at the agency on the final order level.
Thanks. I do want to stress for Representative Lowe's comfort and everybody else that is concerned about this, that the bill expressed agency to modify, and the only limited by two things. Number one, it has to be done on the record so that everyone has to show their work, basically, so everyone can see where that departure has occurred between the hearing officer and the agency. And the other limitation being that historical facts, that is, just the events that did or did not occur, there is a limitation on the agency's ability to modify those, so the agency can only modify those if the agency determines that there's not a preponderance of evidence in the record to support the hearing officer's findings. Again, based on the notion that as to historical facts, whether an event did or did not occur, that's not an issue of expertise. That's an issue that we ask juries and judges to determine in courthouses all over the state every day of the year. So, thank you. That concludes our lineup of witnesses. What I wish I could show to the committee would be the list of agencies who did not testify today in opposition to the bill. Obviously, this is a bill that I think is Mr. Lazenby and Mr. Schulin and I gave you in our overview is not a bill that is satisfactory to everybody who it is going to affect. And there are some concerns about it. But I will say that through the process of the last year and a half, I think probably, of interim work that we have done, we have the interim group has included a broad range of agencies, the Department of Administrative Services, the Department of Justice, the Governor's Office, in addressing all of the concerns that it felt that it could. We have gotten as far as we have, I think, through some good compromise on the part of all sides. And again, there are a number of people a number of agencies and agency constituencies who 2 years ago were in a strong opposition to House Bill 2948 that are willing to take a look-see this time and willing to proceed with this pilot project. It is a four-year program. We can always amend it in process in 2 years' time, but with that, I guess I'll conclude my remarks. I'm sounding more like an advocate than a committee chair, but it is my bill after all.
Okay.
All right. Now, we have before us. Is there any other discussion among the committee We have before us a good menu to choose from would be Mr. Hendricks's letter, a memo of April 23, and I'll take these one at a time. The -2 amendments clarify that the bill does not apply to agencies and boards that are excluded. That is, if there are certain substantive provisions in the bill that is drafted would have affected the workings of agencies that, in fact, are not required to use hearing officers from the panel. The -2 amendments make it clear that if agency or a board or commission is exempt from the panel, they are exempt from the bill for all purposes. So take these one at a time.
So,
Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
Is it your intent to move all these amendments?
It is.
Would you like me to just move them, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman?
You may do that.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the -2 amendments.
Representative Williams moves -2 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -3 amendments.
Okay, Representative Williams moves the -3 amendments. That was the one I was talking about, the first one related to federal law. Is there any objection to the -3s? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -7 amendments.
-7 amendments. Representative Williams moves the -7s. I think we have some testimony on these regarding requesting a change of a hearing officer. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -10s.
Representative Williams moves the -10 amendments. That is the cleaned up ex parte provisions of the bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -11 amendments.
-11 amendments moved by Representative Williams. This again clarifies the ex parte context only apply to hearings conducted by the panel. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -12 amendments.
Representative Williams moves the -12 amendments. These are Department of Justice amendments relating to the issuance of subpoenas and a showing of need before those subpoenas are issued. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -16 amendments.
Representative Williams moves the -16 amendments. These, again, are Department of Justice amendments relating to specialized knowledge, leaving that as an aspect of an agency's expertise. Is there any objection to the -16s? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the -17
amendments. Representative Williams moves the -17 amendments. These are the Board of Medical Examiner amendments relating to the taking of depositions at the expense of an agency prohibits a hearing officer from requiring that. Is there any objection to the -17s? Hearing? Yes.
This is the one that BME wanted to...
They wanted to further amend. Yeah.
Okay. I'm
good. Okay. So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -20 amendments.
Representative Williams moves the -20 amendments. It exempts the Workers' Compensation Board, but not the division. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -21 amendments.
-21 amendments. This relates to the request for a change in hearing officer and extends the time for the chief hearing officer to implement those rules. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chairman, I've moved the -22 amendments.
-22 amendments moved by Representative Williams. This exempts the Oregon Racing Commission. I guess they have to, it turned out, they have hearings they have to conduct to decide photo finishes at races. And I think it was probably be difficult to convene the panel to get down to the racetrack to decide the photo finish. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Maybe not, Mr. Chairman. Most of them are already there. Mr. Chairman, I've moved the -23 amendments.
Representative Williams moves the -23 amendments. These are the historical fact and de novo review amendments that we discussed. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chairman, I move the -24 amendments.
Representative Williams moves the -24 amendments. These exempt the superintendent of public instruction. It was intended that elected officials and constitutional agencies officers be exempted from the agency, from the bill. That was an oversight that they were included when the bill was dropped. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
And in the words of Mr. Hendricks at the bottom of his memo, I hope this is helpful. And Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2525 to the floor. To Ways and Means. So I'd move it to the floor if I could.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll move it to Ways and Means as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2525 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Zachary?
Aye.
Representative Hendricks?
Aye.
Representative Joel?
Aye.
Representative Verbalow? Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Will?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Chair
Federley?
Aye.
House Bill Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Witt, and is he the only one?
He's the only one.
Okay, excused. Thank you, committee, for your hard work today. Thank you very much. Appreciate your support. We will be adjourned.
Great.